From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
A biker gang dispute turned massively deadly in Texas. The Patriot Act fight is going down to the wire, and Los Angeles will raise its minimum wage to $15, eventually. Hello and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at the New York Times. On the left, Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at truthdig.com, is at KCRW in Santa Monica. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, is on the right, joining me here in New York, as is special guest Heather McGee, president of the Demos think tank. Welcome to all of you. The Patriot Act expires on June 1st, and on Wednesday, Senator Rand Paul took the Senate floor for 10 hours to rail against the surveillance law. Last week, the House overwhelmingly passed a bill that reauthorizes most of the Patriot Act while paring back certain controversial practices, like the bulk collection of phone records. Then the House left town for recess. As we go to tape on Friday, the law faces an uncertain fate in the Senate, with Democrats and several Republicans wanting to pass the House bill. But Senator Mitch McConnell doesn't like that bill, and instead he wants a 2-month extension of the old law. Bob, how important is it which direction this goes? There's been a lot of focus on the bulk collection of phone records, but do you see these two law options as being very different in terms of what they mean for surveillance in the United States?
Well, yes. I think the important thing is that we're having a debate. A vast majority of the House, I forget the numbers, 333, I think, to 88, have said that they want change. And some of the 88 who voted against it, including some Republicans, said it doesn't go far enough. That's the position of Rand Paul. And he's offered in his filibuster in the Senate, which I think is quite wonderful, in terms of what he said and his critique. He offered very specific amendments that go further than the House bill. I think the House bill is preferable to the existing legislation, but the Paul amendments would make it tougher, and I hope they are seen and they take in the executive order 12333, which is really important, which would allow a president to sort of violate the spirit of the House bill.
You know, Rich, as Bob noted, Chris Christie came out with some pretty aggressive remarks in defense of the law as it is. Mitch McConnell has been a strong proponent of that. But it feels like a lot of the Republican Party has fallen away from the Patriot Act, including a majority of Republican members of the House of Representatives. Rand Paul has made it a signature issue. Where do you think Republicans are on this? And do you think that either side has the advantage in the Republican primary, either being pro-Patriot Act or pro-reform of the Patriot Act?
The party is obviously divided. I think the high tide of Paulism on this issue has receded a bit, and we'll see that play out in the presidential primaries. And this filibuster was really a fizzle. I mean, it got very little attention, very little play. Rand Paul was quite accommodating, actually, the Senate leadership. He did this 10-hour speech in what is the insiders call an intervening day when no votes were scheduled. So it had absolutely no effect on delaying anything whatsoever, but allowed him to get the fundraising emails out, which is important for any candidate. And I think where this will end up is some extremely short-term extension, probably not the 2 months that Mitch McConnell wants, maybe more like 2 weeks. And then there'll be some sort of deal between the House and the Senate that will look more like what the House has passed than what McConnell wants. And I think the key thing is the metadata will be stored with the phone companies rather than with the government. But I think one of the reasons that you have this strong bipartisan majority in the House in favor of that approach is just the key dishonesty about this program has gotten so much traction. The idea that the government is listening to our phone calls, which just isn't true. This is data that in a massive database of numbers, of length of calls, of times of calls, that's only tapped into to find in numbers associated with the phone number that we have found in Pakistan and Yemen and have reason to believe belongs to a terrorist. And if you want to go any further than that and get into content, well, then you go and get a warrant.
You know, Heather, it's funny what Rich describes here, the question of does it matter who's looking at your phone records? There's a lot of focus on the police state in the sense of high-tech things the federal government might do. But it seems to me like for the average American, the most intrusive law enforcement interactions they have are with local police using perfectly low-tech methods.
Right. Like pulling you over for being black or like finding you something that's going to make you not be able to pay your rent for not wearing a seatbelt, as we saw in Ferguson. You're absolutely right.
But so then what should be made of this national conversation? Should there be more of a link between the discussion of the Patriot Act and the discussion that we get out of, you know, Baltimore and Ferguson and those sorts of things about the way we interact with the government as police?
Well, I'd like to see more, actually, honestly, of a left-right or black-white, conservative, liberal alliance on this question. I mean, what is more of a government overreach? The ability to have an agent of the government execute a 12-year-old boy who's playing with a toy gun in an open carry state, or you know, what we're talking about in terms of some of the high-tech privacy incursions that, frankly, people don't really feel. So I wish that there was more of a civil libertarian response from the right to what's going on with black people and police in this country.
You know, Bob, I mean, the one place where I think we have seen that synthesis is with Rand Paul, who has made both of these issues a really central issue. He's come under criticism, as Rich laid out, for this filibuster not really being a filibuster. But it seems to me that you can look at where Rand Paul was on this issue a few years ago and where he is now and where the country is now. It seems like the country's moved more toward him, at least on the surveillance stuff, and the other way around. The main way he's had impact has been through public opinion change, not through procedural acts in the Senate.
I think the consensus, I guess, of the three people other than myself on the show is that somehow the Fourth Amendment is not a terribly vital document, that spying by the federal government is not as threatening as what local police might do. First of all, that's a distinction without a difference, because if you look at local police departments now, they're armed like military units. Palantir, a CIA-created agency, is actually doing the data mining for the Los Angeles Police Department, the New Orleans Police, and probably every other police department in the country, and they do it for the 17 intelligence agencies, and they combine the two. So if you have a grassroots movement, whether it's an Occupy movement or a Tea Party movement or anything else, your local police are going to be in cahoots with the FBI and the CIA and everyone else, mining that massive data treasure chest that the three of you seem to think is insignificant, and they're going to do to that average person what the FBI did to Martin Luther King, which is to try to destroy him and drive him to suicide. Only now the FBI has tools that they couldn't even imagine they would have had when Martin Luther King was operating, including being able to see how far he reads in a book, what his phone conversations are, who he has dinner with, and everything else. And so the idea that somehow, you know, you're going to pit the police stopping someone at a corner and shooting them, and then that's, let's forget the other issue. No, they're one and the same. You either have a free society in which the rights of individuals and their sovereignty is protected, and we have limited government, or you go about mocking the very goal of limited government, and you say, trust the federal government.
I just want to stand up for Heather. I want to stand up for Heather briefly.
Well, stand up
for yourself,
Rich. I
believe she does not agree with me on this issue.
That's right. Bob, I do agree with you. Actually, what I was saying is that I really do believe that there should be, and I'm afraid that the only reason that there isn't more common cause from the right wing, who's very incensed about these issues, I think in many ways justifiably, is because of racial bias. And I would love to see more of a sense of common humanity that would link these issues together. That's all I'm saying.
Go ahead, very quickly.
Can I just briefly address the Fourth Amendment issue? The Fourth Amendment is not an ink blot. If we disagree with a policy, it must violate the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is meant to protect our persons and our property, and you don't own your own metadata. And the Supreme Court has extended the Fourth Amendment over time to say it applies in cases where you have an expectation of privacy. And you don't have an expectation of privacy over something that belongs to a third party. And I have shocking news to break to all our listeners today. Throughout his entire lifetime, agents of the government have been looking at Bob Scheer's correspondence. They're called mailmen. And the reason why that's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment is because Bob has no expectation of privacy when it comes to the outside of the envelopes of letters he sends to people or people send to him.
Let us know what you think about the Patriot Act fight at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, a biker gang dispute turned deadly in Texas, and Los Angeles is raising its minimum wage. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, author of the new book, They Know Everything About You. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, is on the right, and Heather McGee of Demos is also with us. So last Sunday, a shootout at a Twin Peaks restaurant in Waco, Texas, involving three biker gangs led to 9 deaths, over a dozen injuries, and over 100 arrests. And a lot of the media treated the story as kind of an oddity, like who knew there were biker gangs anymore? It was a marked contrast from coverage of the civil unrest in Baltimore, unrest in which, I should note, nobody died, though Baltimore has had an overall uptick in murders this year. Heather, what do you make of the difference in the way the media has treated these two stories?
So I think that there has been a really great and robust conversation about this. I mean, I think it shows that the Black Lives Matter movement has really penetrated our media narrative, that immediately was one of the threads of conversation about this, is how is a massive melee with semi-automatic weapons and lots of deaths going to be compared to the civil unrest in Baltimore, where the only real violence was against property, if you don't, of course, count the violence against Freddie Gray. You know, I think it's similar to the way that Clive and Bundy became a sort of right-wing darling for really menacing the federal government and having hundreds of people take up arms against agents of the government in that standout. And if you just put black faces on those ranchers, how the conversation would have been different. It is so important that we recognize as a country right now how racism has evolved, what unconscious bias and prejudice is, how much the stories that we tell about African Americans, about Latino immigrants, help shape the policies that the average American thinks that they can support or not. And part in this conversation about Waco and Baltimore, while, you know, obviously detracting from a really big tragedy in Waco, is, I think, an important part of us moving that conversation forward.
Usually when you have mass shootings involving white people, you end up with a lot of conversation about gun control as the like policy outshot. And I don't think we've seen that here either. This has been the rare mass shooting that has been treated as basically not having policy implications. And I wonder whether that's the right approach, and it's the rest of the time that we're taking the wrong approach. I mean, there probably is no direct policy implication other than certain things about what should be done with policing in Waco. Maybe there are things that need to be done about biker gangs, but I think the intuition correctly is that this is a fairly localized problem not requiring a national conversation.
I think that's basically right. Look, there's a vast number of guns in this country. Private gun ownership's gone way, way up, and violent crime has gone down, except for mostly in some poorly policed inner city areas. And the idea, you know, some people are saying, look, some people called the Baltimore rioters thugs, and they're not calling the biker gangs, members of the biker gangs thugs. Well, that's because there's already extreme negative connotation to being a member of a biker gang, especially an outlaw biker gang. And a very important thing happened when the shootout occurred, and it was correctly termed a shootout, not a riot, because they weren't rampaging through Waco. They were just shooting one another. Armed policemen came and put a stop to it. Immediately shot 4 of the guys. They arrested something like 170 of them. The bail for a lot of them was set at $1 million, and it stopped right away. You know, in contrast, the mayor of Baltimore created a safe space for rioting. And I think just one last point on this, it is outrageous that we're not talking about how in the last 30 days, 39 people have been murdered in Baltimore. And that doesn't figure. It's not on anyone's radar screen. It's not part of the media conversation because there's no political hay to be made out of it. So those black lives, unfortunately, don't matter as much as they should in our media conversation.
So are you going there, Rich, to say that the mostly white media is not concerned about those murders, or that the black citizens of Baltimore are not concerned about those murders? Because if you asked black people in Baltimore who have seen their jobs disappear, who have seen, and there is a policy around biker gangs, because most of the trade of biker gangs is in international drugs, so there is a drug policy question here, have seen drugs sort of take the place of jobs in so many places, they would say, trust me, that those black lives did matter.
The media doesn't care. Where's the cable debate about why 39 people have been murdered in Baltimore the last 30 days?
Okay.
Where is it? It's almost invisible.
Those
black lives should matter.
Let me give you this.
Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's absurd to say there's no debate about why we have violence in the black community. It has to do with failed schools. It has to do with a whole approach of containing people, locking them up, the disproportionate sentencing of people, the destruction of the black family, the lack of opportunities. There's a lot of debate about poverty in the black community, violence in the black community. How can you say people are indifferent to it? The question is whether you want to do something about it or whether you want to just have containment cells of neighborhoods where you keep people out of sight, out of mind. I think the whole progressive agenda is precisely one of having programs, including making the schools more effective, jobs, as was pointed out by Heather, and what has had. I think the next subject we're going to discuss, the minimum wage is very important so that work pay and that it be an opportunity for advancement and not another a form of impoverishment. And I do think the failure of the society to deal in a meaningful way with the impoverishment and the fracturing of particularly black and brown communities in America is a major preoccupation of any kind of progressive left, and that's a left that, and a progressive view that has been abandoned by the mainstream of the Democratic and Republican Party and, yes, the mainstream media.
Bob, my point is a very specific one. Where is the debate over these 39 murders? Are there cable shows debating it?
Let me answer that, by the way, in terms of media. I was in Baltimore during this rioting. I was at the Real News Network, which is a great outfit that has primarily young and mostly third world people working there, manning the cameras. They were out on the streets every day of this whole business in Baltimore, whatever you want to call it, insurrection, riot, what have you. So it is not true that it's not true.
You're making my point for me.
Yeah, it's a point against the mass media.
Just one last thing really quickly. Yeah, people did cover the CVS burning.
No. They cover poverty in Baltimore on a daily basis.
But these murders are not on the radar screen. I haven't seen the debates. I'm missing the broadcast news coverage of this. Morning Joe, I give Morning Joe mentioned it. But I haven't seen it elsewhere.
What is there to debate, though? Yeah. Because, I mean, when you're going to have a national conversation about something, for lack of a better word, it's not just about the magnitude of the problem. It's about where the solution can come from. Generally, you want to talk nationally about things the federal government can do things about. The idea, I think, in Ferguson was that there were systematic abuses, some that were the state government's responsibility that had to do with financing of municipalities and using fines instead of taxes. And some of them have to do with the fact that the Justice Department is supposed to supervise local police departments when they abuse people. I guess the question is, what is there for the country to do about violence in Baltimore?
I don't understand that point of view at all. So we're saying something can be done when there's a police abuse, but when a neighborhood is out of control and young men's lives are being destroyed on a daily basis, there's nothing that can be done? Well, there can. You've seen New York. New York's policing made a difference. Baltimore has been lagging behind New York forever because the police department has been so poorly run, the city has been so mismanaged, and lives are being destroyed from it every day, and it almost doesn't make a ripple in the media environment.
The massive difference between New York City, at least the parts of New York City that you spend time in, I'm sure, and Baltimore is not actually about the quality, I put that in quotes, of the policing, but rather about the economy, right? The New York City economy has been flourishing. The Baltimore economy has been cratering, particularly in those communities. You really can't say that policing is going to be a cause of the socioeconomic status of a community.
Oh, it definitely plays a role, whether businesses go there, stay there, whether it's safe or not.
Okay, look.
That just seems obvious. Now, maybe there's a relationship that goes the other way, but I'm sure the relationship goes both ways.
Okay,
people
cool.
aren't going to go and start a business in places that are dangerous. That's just common sense. And by the way, shootings are up in New York and murders are up in New York.
One thought in here. It's not a question of policing. It's policing that in some way it tries to understand the community that's being policed. And I think in Los Angeles, for instance, we've had a very big shift in policing from basically a racist department that was alienated from the community to a far greater involvement. So it's a question of what kind of policing. But Heather's point is absolutely correct. There are a lot in Baltimore. The whole solution to social problems of unemployment, opportunity, and everything was gentrification. Gentrification is not a solution. And we have to get serious about the quality of education and integrating people into the economy and giving them jobs. That's why the next subject, the minimum wage and decent jobs, is so relevant.
That's a great segue, Bob. I want to move to one more topic that deals with the economy in Los Angeles, where the city council voted this week to raise the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour. LA will join Seattle and San Francisco, but not right away. As in other cities, the minimum wage increase is being phased in and will not take full effect until 2020. So, Heather, there's been this national push for higher minimum wages. And I guess my question here is, how high is too high? Especially because in California, you can't have what's called a tip waiver. So if you're a tipped employee, you get $15 plus the tip. It's pushing the effective minimum wage for tip occupations to somewhere in the low 20s. At what point do you actually start to see negative effects on employment from a minimum wage increase?
I think it's really rough for people in our economic status to ask the question of how high is too high when we're talking about essentially still poverty wage jobs. And the fact that this is a very slow and incremental raise. Think about the fact that we're not getting to $15 in LA until 2020. By then, it'll be the equivalent of about $13.75. If you also think about the fact that LA County has a much higher cost of living, so that the average worker there has to make 40% more in order to earn the equivalent as the average worker across the U.S., 538 did this calculation, and it would be about $9.75 in 2020, the actual equivalent. So just, you know, moderating our sort of hysterics about the optics of 15, which frankly, I love. All the people who have been working to try to lift the floor love the idea of one of the biggest cities in the country sending the signal that 15 is a demand that low-paid workers themselves have been pushing and that it is going to be met. When we're looking at all of the burdens that a working family faces, childcare, higher education, which is often thought of for some reason as still an elite project, when in fact the vast majority of people who graduate from high school go on to some college, right? Whether it's a community college or a state school. When we look at healthcare, when we look at transportation, these are all massive costs that are simply not being met, not only at the minimum, but also at the median in this country. So $15 is really modest, certainly if you think about it really being about $9.75 in 2020 in LA in real terms. And it's an important victory for the people who've worked very hard to change this national conversation from one of tax cuts and austerity to one of paying workers more for the work that they do.
But I mean, it's not just a question of what people deserve or what pays for a certain standard of living. It's this empirical question. There's been a lot of economic research over the last couple of decades, basically showing that minimum wage increases roughly into the $10 an hour range don't seem to have significant disemployment effects.
And that's been again, Josh. Say it again.
No, it's the, but so that
wait, raising the minimum wage does not actually kill jobs
within this band. But the question is where the band ends. Like, you couldn't set a minimum wage of $60 an hour. So I guess the minimum wage helps people support their families and pay for these necessities, unless
and helps
it pushes
create jobs and stimulate the economy by putting more money in the pockets of low-paid workers.
Only to a point. Eventually,
but we don't know yet.
That's my point. But so that's my question is, you know, like when would you how high should we go? Should they have gone to 20?
I'll tell you exactly how high we should go. We should get our heads out of the textbooks and all of the data. The textbooks 30 years ago would have said that even to $10 would have caused massive layoffs. We know that real-world experiences are actually, because they're about 1,000 different factors that go into creating the economic climate of a community. And so if we are saying that the only option is to either create an economic formula, all of which have actually been refuted by real world experiences over the past 10 years of localized minimum wages, or continue to allow working families to not be able to contribute economically to their communities, to not be able to go out shopping, to not be able to pay their rent, to not be able to buy a new car, I don't think there's even a choice.
Rich, it's interesting how both the left and the right have talked about this issue, I think, in the last few years, where I think there's been a reluctance on the left to sort of admit a trade-off, but there's also been a reluctance on the right to acknowledge the empirical research. There's a sort of when people on the right talk about the minimum wage, they tend to talk from economic first principles and, you know, price controls reduce demand or whatever. But hasn't that research been convincing that at least some minimum wage increase, if not to $15, is desirable policy?
My understanding of the research, and I confess I can't go toe-to-toe with you on economic wonkery, Josh, is that it's kind of all over the place on the moderate minimum wage, but this isn't a moderate minimum wage increase. And it's just a classic case of the proverbial forgotten man, where you won't hear about the kid who just needs some skills, needs some training, needs to get on that bottom rung of the ladder, who won't be able to get there, or that rung won't exist for him anymore.
They
so that's
will, because
that's the
teenagers
downside.
Teenagers still have
of the
a sub-minimum wage in California. Teenagers still have a sub-minimum wage in California of 85%.
Well,
for the
you're
first
still if you're
hours.
going that high, certainly you're going to be losing jobs at the margin.
No,
so
see,
I would think if there are going to be just one last thing, sorry, on a right-left consensus on this, it would be around the earned income tax credit, which is a subsidy for work that doesn't have the downsides of the minimum wage, both in increasing prices and depressing employment.
Bob, I want to get to you quickly before we go.
Yeah, let me just say, first of all, it's not a left-right issue. When there were some moderate Republicans around, they favored an increased minimum wage, which has been held back. The minimum wage has not been increasing to keep up with inflation all these decades. That's one problem. And there's a recognition that one way to deal, by the way, with undocumented labor, which was what Republicans in California, when they were moderate, did, is to have a decent minimum wage so that if there are jobs there, people will take them who are documented. Number two, this is subsidized employment. What McDonald's and Walmart are doing is getting the rest of us taxpayers to pay for their workforce. And that's the real issue. We are subsidizing it with health care. We're subsidizing it with all kinds of programs and so forth. And so when you have this a false labor market created with government support, the question is, why not do it more sensibly? And the L.A. system answered a very important argument. That's why it was so significant. You're not doing it as an island of opportunity. With the, for the second largest city in America, now the county of L.A. will follow. You are setting a national floor. So Seattle will not be so-called punished. And the fact is, people are still going to go to restaurants, you know, and they're still going to go to McDonald's. And McDonald's is going to stay in business, only we'll finally have McDonald's have to dip into their profit and their executive compensation and maybe pay their workers a little bit more of what they need to get by. That's the issue here. We are right now subsidizing. We taxpayers are subsidizing their workforce. This forces them to pay a decent wage.
Well, let us know what you think about the L.A. minimum wage increase at kcrw.com/LRC. We've made it to that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Heather McGee, what's on your mind?
So my big pet peeve is the idea that we can't afford debt-free college for, frankly, my generation and my future children's generation, when it was the norm and could be afforded by this great country when we invented the greatest middle class that the world has ever seen for the baby boom generation. And since then, there have been cuts by state governments of about 26 cents on the dollar. And why now? Why now when we've also made labor market policy decisions that make the middle class not affordable, for not attainable to someone who doesn't have a college degree, would we say that students trying to get there have to shoulder $30,000 in debt?
Rich Lowry, what's your rant?
Sidney Blumenthal has such a reputation as a poisonous hatchet man for the Clintons that Obama aides actually banned him from working with Hillary Clinton at the State Department. Now we find that Hillary got around it with Blumenthal working at the Clinton Foundation and sending her memos about Libya. At the same time, he's associated with people trying to do business in Libya. In no universe, except perhaps Clinton world, is that okay.
Bob Scheer, your soapbox.
Yes. The good thing about Rand Paul standing up and a few other Republicans, as well as obviously Senator Wyden and others, is it takes the lesser evil argument to a different level. Is Hillary Clinton the lesser evil on this issue? Why isn't she outspoken in challenging the surveillance state? And when we get to that all-important issue of what kind of people you want on the Supreme Court, would a Democratic president really be more pro-civil liberties than some of the Republicans we have out there?
That's all we have time for today. I'm going to have to forego my rant. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Heather McGee. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director was J.C. Swadek. Our production assistant is Sarah Singer Schiff. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.